Others hear the good news. About that time at Port Moresby, Lance and Daphne Gossin started studying with several young men who came from Kerama, a coastal village about 140 miles west of Port Moresby. When the men returned home for vacation, Lance and Jim Chambliss decided to visit them for 2 weeks to take the good news to Kerama. "The whole village gathered together to listen to us," writes Lance. "During our presentation, the local London Missionary Society pastor stormed in and attacked our interpreter, punching him several times before the villagers intervened. He insisted that the local people did not want us there and ordered us to leave his area. We replied that those who wanted to listen to us could accompany us to the other side of the village, while the rest could stay with him. The whole village followed us. The next morning, we went to see the district commissioner to report what had happened. On the way there, we met a woman who was very ill. We offered to take her to the local hospital, but she was afraid to go. Only after much persuasion did she finally agree to accompany us. After leaving her with the hospital doctor, we called on the district commissioner, who clearly did not welcome our visit. In fact, he angrily accused us of teaching people not to accept medical help. Just then, however, the hospital doctor walked in and overheard his accusation. He told the commissioner that we had just persuaded a sick woman to go to the hospital for medical treatment. The commissioner, to his credit, immediately apologized. He told us that the local Catholic priest had just visited him and misrepresented our beliefs. He then assigned 2 armed policemen to protect us from further trouble. It was quite an experience to have policemen with rifles sitting in on our Bible studies. The following is from pages 107 and 108 of the printed edition. He was grateful that he went to the wrong school. Michael Saunga, born 1936, baptized 1962. Profile: became a special pioneer in September 1964 and has served as a special pioneer longer than anyone else in Papua New Guinea.
In 1959, I moved to Rabaul to advance my education. When I heard that the Witnesses had a school, I went to the home of the teacher, Lance Gasson, thinking that I was going to a vocational school. Lance invited me to join in the Bible study that was held every Wednesday. Despite the misunderstanding, I accepted the invitation. I deeply appreciated what I learned, especially that God's name is Jehovah, and that there will be a new heavens and a new earth. 2 Peter 3:13. I was baptized on the morning of July 7, 1962, ever so grateful that I had gone to the wrong school. That same day, I attended a meeting for those interested in pioneer service. The conductor, John Cutforth, who was the district overseer, stressed that the fields were white for harvesting and that more workers were needed. As soon as I was able, I enrolled as a vacation pioneer, as auxiliary pioneers were then called. In May 1964, I became a regular pioneer, and in September, a special pioneer. I recall an occasion when I was preaching near Rabaul. A Tolai man asked if he could hold my Bible to read a text for himself. When I gave him the Bible, he tore it into pieces and threw it on the ground. Rather than get angry, I reported the matter to the police commander, who immediately dispatched a constable to arrest the offender. The commander told the man, "You are a bad man. You broke God's law and the law of the government. You must buy a new Bible for the man tomorrow, and if you don't, we will send you to jail." The commander then told me to come to the police station at 10 o'clock the following morning to pick up the money for the Bible. When I arrived, the money was waiting for me. Since then, many Tolai people have come into the truth. On another occasion, I was with a group of witnesses distributing the Kingdom News in an area west of Wewak. The others were working ahead of me. A local village leader, however, found out what the brothers were doing and collected the copies they had distributed. He must have known that I was coming, for he was waiting for me in the middle of the road, his hands on his hips, with copies of the Kingdom News in one hand. I asked if there was a problem. He held them out to me and said, "I'm in charge here, and I don't want you distributing these." I took them from him. Meanwhile, villagers had gathered around. Looking at them, I asked, "If you want to work in your garden or go fishing, do you have to get official permission?" "No," said one lady. Then I asked the villagers, "Do you want to read this?" "Yes," they said. So I redistributed the copies of the Kingdom News unopposed. Later, though, I had to defend myself before a meeting of some 20 village leaders. Happily, all but two voted in favor of our preaching work. Returning to the account.
Soon afterward, two young Australians, Jim Smith and Lionel Dingle, were assigned to Karama as special pioneers. They immediately set to work learning Taruma, the local language. We said each word in Motu, and our Bible students told us the corresponding Taruma word, which we wrote down, explains Jim. In this way, we built up a small vocabulary and memorized a simple Bible presentation. The local people were amazed to hear us speaking their language, as no other Europeans in the district could do so. After 3 months, we were conducting weekly meetings in Taruma on both sides of Karama Bay. Later, Glenn Finley, another young Australian pioneer, took over from Jim and Lionel and preached alone in Karama for 18 months. "It was a testing time for me," says Glenn, "and I sometimes wondered if my work was accomplishing anything. But then a humbling experience changed my view. One of my Bible students was an elderly village baker named Havaka. He was totally illiterate and after some months had managed to retain only a few basic truths. I wondered if it was worthwhile teaching him. Then one morning, as I approached his home, I heard a voice and stopped to listen. It was Havaka praying aloud to Jehovah, thanking him in earnest tones for teaching him the truth about his name and the kingdom. His sincere prayer reminded me that Jehovah looks at people's hearts, not their intellect. He well knows those who love him." Confronting a cargo cult. In 1960, two other Australian special pioneers, Stephen Blundy and Alan Husking, moved to Savaiviri, a village about 30 miles east of Karama. After living in a tent for 3 months, Stephen and Alan moved into a small bush house on a coconut plantation surrounded by a vast swamp. Savaiviri was a renowned cargo cult stronghold. How did this cult begin? During World War II, the locals marveled at the vast wealth or cargo that accompanied foreign soldiers. Then the war ended, and the soldiers packed up and left. Some villagers reasoned that since the cargo had come from over the horizon, the direction of the spirit world, their dead ancestors must have been sending it to them, but that the soldiers had been intercepting it. To alert the spirits to their need, the people engaged in mock military drills and built sturdy wharves to prepare for the glorious day when a flood of new cargo would arrive. Before long, Stephen and Alan were studying with some 250 cargo cult members, including its leader and some of his 12 apostles. "Many of these people came into the truth," relates Stephen. Indeed, the local government patrol officer later told us that our preaching was instrumental in bringing the Savaiviri cargo cult to an end. Producing Bible literature. Those early pioneers quickly saw the value of translating Bible literature into the local languages. But how could they provide literature to 820 different language groups? In 1954, Tom Kiddo took the first step by arranging for local brothers to translate a chapter of the book Let God Be True, published by Jehovah's Witnesses but now out of print, into Motu, the local Port Moresby language. Over 200 copies of that mimeographed chapter, entitled The New Earth, were distributed in pamphlet form, delighting many Motu-speaking people. As new areas opened up, pioneers toiled long and hard to translate literature into other local languages. Jim Smith relates, "By writing down new words and expressions, I painstakingly compiled a Taruma dictionary and notes on grammar, which I used to translate Watchtower study articles. I often worked late into the night typing up translated articles on sheets of paper to distribute to people attending the meetings. Later, I translated a tract and a booklet into Teruma. Those early publications helped many Karama people to learn the truth. Other publications were produced in Hula and Toaripi. Since it seemed impossible to print publications in every language, the brothers later concentrated their efforts on the two trade languages, Hirimotu and Tokpisin. Hirimotu, a simplified form of Motu, was spoken by many people along the Papuan coast. "We worked hard to improve the written form of this language," says Don Fielder. Indeed, the Watchtower and our other publications in Hirimotu did much to develop the language to its present comprehensive form. Tokpisin, a blend of English, German, Quenua, and other languages, is widely spoken in the highlands, coastal regions, and islands in northern Papua New Guinea. How did the preaching work get started in that diverse territory? The good news spreads north. In June 1956, newlywed pioneers Ken and Rosina Frame were the first witnesses to move to New Ireland, an island in the Bismarck Archipelago in northeast Papua New Guinea. Ken, an accountant, worked with a large trading company in Kavieng, the main town on the island. "Before we left Sydney," Ken relates, "we were advised to let people get used to us before we started to preach openly. Rosina was a good dressmaker and soon had many customers. We witnessed to them informally, and soon there was a small group of interested ones meeting discreetly at our home once a week." 18 months later, John Cutforth, the circuit overseer, visited us and asked if he could show the film The Happiness of the New World Society. I spoke to the owner of the local cinema, and he agreed to screen our free mission film without charge. His staff must have spread the word about the show. When we arrived at the cinema, the entrance was packed with people, and we needed help from the police to make our way inside. Over 230 people attended the screening, not counting those peering in through the open windows. After this event, we preached more openly. In July 1957, a congregation was established at Rabaul, New Britain, a pretty harbor town flanked by two active volcanoes. The Rabaul congregation met in the backyard of a house rented by special pioneers. "Over 100 people came to the house every night to study the Bible," says pioneer Norm Shireen. "We divided them up into groups of about 20 and taught them by lamplight under the trees." When the congregation hosted its first circuit assembly, 7 persons were baptized at a local beach. 5 of them soon took up the pioneer ministry. But where could they best serve? The Australia branch office provided the answer: Madang. At Madang, a town on the northeast mainland coast, the fields were ripe for harvesting. In fact, the small group of publishers there could barely keep pace with the level of interest. When Canadian pioneer Matthew Pope and his family arrived and purchased a house with several backyard cabins, the way was open to send in more pioneers. 8 pioneers arrived from Rabaul and spread out into the Madang district. One of them, Tamil Murung, obtained a bicycle and traveled by coastal boat to Buskin, his home village, 30 miles north of Madang. After preaching in Buskin, he rode his bicycle back to Madang, witnessing as he went. He then returned to Buskin, established a congregation, and pioneered for another 25 years. During that time, he married and raised a family. His daughter and his niece later served at Bethel. Meanwhile, in Madang, John and Lena Davison met Kulup Kanai, a schoolteacher from Tulladig, a small village between Buskin and Madang. Before long, John and Lena were traveling out to Tulladig to study with Kulup and his relatives. This incurred the wrath of the school inspector, a Catholic, who ordered the police to evict Kulup and his relatives from their homes. Undeterred, the group moved to Bugaldig, a neighboring village, and grew into a thriving congregation. They later built a large kingdom hall that was used for assemblies and conventions. Now there are 7 congregations and 2 groups in the Madang district. The following is from page 101 of the printed edition. We will never give up. Kalip Kanai, born 1922, baptized 1962. Profile, one of the first people to accept the truth in the Madang area, as told by his son Ulpep Kalip.
My father was a humble man and a deep thinker. When faced with a problem, he would listen carefully and analyze the matter before finally offering his opinion. When I was 15, I was hospitalized in Madang because a shark bit my leg off just below the knee. While visiting me, my father met John Davison. In the New World, John said, Jehovah can give your son a new leg. Father's interest was aroused. He began studying the Bible in earnest, and he soon developed a strong faith. Because my father and his relatives had left the Catholic Church, the police were incited to evict us from our homes. Our 12 houses, set among lush flowering gardens, were less than a year old. The police threw blazing torches onto the thatched roofs, which burst into flames. We rushed to salvage our belongings, but burning embers and smoke drove us outside. We wept as our homes were reduced to ashes. With heavy hearts, we walked to Bogaldig, the neighboring village, where the village chief kindly allowed us to move into a small one-room hut. There, my father addressed our family. Jesus was persecuted, so we can expect that people will persecute us too. But we will never give up our faith. Returning to the account.
While Madang was opening up, Jim Baird and John and Magdalene Endor were making good progress in Lai, a large coastal town some 130 miles to the southeast. We studied with large groups of people at our home nearly every night. Within 6 months, 10 of our Bible students joined us in service, recalls John. Later that year, more than 1,200 people attended a screening of the film The New World Society in Action at the Lai Picture Theater. Many in the audience were contract workers who carried the good news back to their remote mountain villages. Inland from Lai, stalwart publishers were also doing good work. At War, Jack Arafei, a big, round-faced man with a real zeal for serving Jehovah, had established a thriving congregation in his home. About 30 members of the Kukukuku tribe, once feared cannibals, were also studying the Bible and making good spiritual progress. Meanwhile, at neighboring Bulolo, Wally and Joy Busbridge's zealous preaching aroused the ire of the new tribe's mission, which regarded the area as its exclusive domain. As a result of pressure from the mission, Wally's employer gave him an ultimatum. Give up your religion or find another job. Wally and Joy moved to Lai and kept on preaching. They later entered the full-time ministry and spent years in the traveling work. Papandetta, a small town southeast of Lai, heard the good news through Jerome and Lavinia Hatota, who returned to their home province from Port Moresby. Jerome had plenty of initiative and used the scriptures persuasively, while Lavinia was a warm-hearted woman who showed real personal interest in others. True to form, when they started witnessing, the Anglican bishop and a large group of his followers soon arrived at their house demanding that they stop. But Jerome and Lavinia refused to be intimidated. They kept on preaching and established a small but zealous congregation. By 1963, the good news had reached Wewak, a town on Papua New Guinea's remote northern coast. Carl Tainer and Otto Eberhardt, two German builders, worked on the Wewak hospital by day and studied with over 100 interested people during evenings and weekends. Their preaching enraged the local Catholic priest, who gathered a mob and threw Carl and Otto's motorbikes into the sea. One of the priest's accomplices, a prominent village leader, had a son who later became a witness. Impressed by the improvements he saw in his son's lifestyle, the man's attitude softened, and he granted the witnesses permission to preach in the villages that were under his control.